we consider the mighty evergreen and the humble Christmas tree with its lights that twinkle on a winter's night. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The evergreen has become a symbol of Christmas for millions of people around the world. Long before the tradition took hold, evergreens were symbols of fertility and light, commerce, and industry. Author Trent Presler is from South Dakota. His new book looks at trees that have shaped America. It's a biography of a nation that begins through the lens of the Christmas tree.
As with so many things, it started during COVID. And the first COVID Christmas, when everyone was really sad and wearing masks and still doing social distancing, I decided to leave the house and go shop for a Christmas tree. And, you know, I'd been home alone for a very long time. It's not like I was even having people over for Christmas, but I just thought this would cheer me up somehow. So I traipsed out to this tree farm in suburban Long Island where I was living at the time. And I pull in the driveway, and it's one of those tree farms that has like reindeer and Mariah Carey music and an ice skating rink. And, you know, it's an absolute Christmas extravaganza. And to my shock, there were people driving out of this parking lot with Christmas trees on the roofs of their car, but the trees had been spray painted fluorescent colors. They were red and pink and purple and blue. And I had never seen anything like this before. I thought, what is going on? The evergreens are not green. So I asked one of the employees who, you know, poor thing, is probably a 22-year-old on home from Christmas break. He was stressed out. There were a million tourists there. But I said, hey, what's up with these colored trees? And he said, well, first of all, they're our best sellers. But we started spray painting our trees green because they were turning brown. Because we have so many droughts and heat stress, and with climate change, it's getting a lot harder to grow Christmas trees that people like. And I said, so you started spray painting them green? He said, yeah. And then it was popular, so then we just got other colors and started painting them every color of the rainbow. But I thought, there has to be a story here.
And you begin the book in South Dakota with a childhood memory of cutting down a Christmas tree with your dad, a very different experience than the pink spray-painted Christmas tree.
Yes.
Take us there.
So I grew up on a cattle ranch in western South Dakota on the Standing Rock Reservation. So it was around Meadow, South Dakota, between Lemon and Faith. And we had 10,000 acres of land. And we just took the pickup truck out into the prairie, and it was a blustery, freezing cold, windy December day. And this would have been probably around 1985 or so. And we traipsed up to the top of a ridge, and there was an outcropping of ponderosa pines there. And I was just awestruck that they could even live in that environment. And I figured they just grew there because nothing else could. I mean, this was the prairie, as you know. So there's little tufts of sagebrush coming out of the snow. But otherwise, it's just flat and it's just white. I picked one out that was a lot taller than me, about twice as tall as I was. And my father hacked at it with his hatchet. And it survived a shocking number of blows before it creaked over with a sigh. And then we dragged it back across the prairie to his truck, and the rest of my family was there with us too, and we, you know, then we put it up in the house. But these things always seem to kind of get, they look different indoors than they do outdoors.
This is your earliest memory of wonder. And you write about that beautifully, just lying beneath the tree and looking up. What about having it indoors made that possible for you as a young boy?
Well, suddenly the tree became not so much a wild object as sort of a domesticated pet. And I loved I loved the peace and the serenity of just laying underneath of it. I would take naps and fall asleep under the tree and just kind of look up and, you know, let those twinkling lights lull me to sleep. It is my earliest memory of a tree, certainly of an evergreen.
And you had to work for it. There's also this element of an effort that you're not dragging it up from the basement and fluffing its branches. There's an effort.
Right.
There's a relationship with you and your father This is this is what it means to be a family, what it means to be a man, what it means to be celebrating Christmas. There's a lot in that moment.
And even in the ornaments, they were all handmade. You know, my mom would make these bird's nests out of pheasant feathers and those salt dough candy canes and a macrame angel that was like starched stiff so it could get on top of the tree and kind of stand there awkwardly. Well, this is the link to authenticity that I think real trees give us and fake trees cannot. You can have nice, real, lovely ornaments on a plastic tree, but I just think when you're decorating a real tree with things that your family made by hand and that have sentimental or even spiritual meaning to you, that becomes part and parcel with our Christmas tradition writ large.
Yeah. You say then very early in the book that to look closely at the evergreen is to look closely at America, to understand America. Mm-hmm. We don't think of that very often. Is that a hypothesis you went into the research of the book having, or was that something that after you had written the book and found all the stories and done all the research that you realized the story of the evergreen is in fact the story of of us, as in the U.S.?
I would love to say that I had that premonition at the start and I'm that smart, but I wasn't. I had to learn that. I had to go really deep before it truly sank in that the story of evergreens is the story of America. And I knew at the outset that I wanted to write a book that was essentially a biography of this country as seen through the singular lens of Christmas trees. But I didn't quite know how deep it would go. And, you know, you start with a chapter outline that your agent sells to a publisher. And in nonfiction, it's kind of a hope and a prayer, like, oh, I've got this brilliant idea. Let me write this book. And then they trust you enough to go out into the world and figure out what it means to write the book you wanted to write. And I learned so many things that by the end, then I wrote that prologue. Where I could say with confidence that the story of the evergreen is the story of America.
And we go back to, you know, ancient, you know, early humans. What were some of the relationships and rituals that early humans had with evergreens?
So pagans in prehistoric times would drag in evergreen trees and branches and boughs, and they would bring them in around the winter solstice as part of pagan rituals. And they did so as kind of a talisman against the fading light, and the trees were a representation of hope that there was light amidst the darkness and that something green and living could persist through the darkness. Early humans decorated them with symbols of fertility. So the red Christmas balls were reminiscent of testicles, and wreaths had a yonic nature to them, and then there were silver threads of tinsel, and it was a fertility ritual, basically. And then there was a pope a very long time ago who was trying to convert the heathens, and he thought, you know, let's have a big tent here. Let's bring in these pagan rituals around the winter solstice, and let's attach the birth of Jesus Christ to that day. And then maybe we can get some of these people that are worshiping their evergreen trees to come on board with us in the Christian faith. I suppose the rest is history, but it's a complicated one.
It is a very complicated one. When did the shift start going from sacred evergreen symbol of light to commodity to this is something we can build civilization upon?
The ancient Romans and the Greeks built their civilizations with evergreens and pines, and then they burnt copious amounts of pines to make metal armaments. And, you know, everyone thinks the Roman Empire fell because of political strife, but they primarily fell because they ran out of trees. They needed more pines, and so Caesar was marching through North Africa and Europe in search of more wood. Even you look at Great Britain and the monarchy in, let's say, the 1500s, by that point in history, they had cut down virtually every single Christmas tree or evergreen or even deciduous tree on the British Isles. And they needed wood badly. They needed strong, straight-trunked trees to make masts for the Royal Navy. So yeah. So they came to America in search of timber. And I really think when they sent the pilgrims here, who, by the way, were not necessarily religious separatists, okay? They were timber merchants. And that, I think, was when the worm turned and it became global commercial commodity.
You have this wonderful story here as I've been watching Ken Burns's American Revolution, and we get ready for 250 years of America celebration. You mentioned the sailing masts and the way that the resources of the era of George Washington, that timber was supposed to go to the British Navy, and people are using it in their floorboards, sometimes as an act of defiance. Tell us a little bit about the role of evergreens in the American Revolution.
Well, sure. Well, the king said, you know, I own every pine tree that's over 24 inches wide. And that's because those thicker trees made really great masts for the Royal Navy. So the colonists went out in defiance of this law, and they started chopping down every pine that was 23 inches wide. And so you often see in pre-colonial homes in New England still today that have the wide pine plank flooring, often those planks are 23 inches wide. Mm. The king was like, well, that doesn't work for me. So how dare you? So now I'm going to claim all the trees, and I'm going to tell you as colonists, you can no longer cut any evergreens. And he sent a surveyor of the woods to the colonies to mark the trees as property of the crown. And there was this poor guy who was having a beer in the Ware Tavern in Ware, New Hampshire. And this angry lumberjack named Ebenezer Mudgett and his crew, they rolled in to this tavern, and they lifted the king's representative upside down, and they lashed him with pine boughs, and then they put him on the back of a horse and like slapped the horse on the rear and sent him out of town. And that became known as the Pine Tree Riot. Hmm. Which actually preceded the Boston Tea Party by a year. So you could rightfully say that America's revolution began with the Pine Tree Riot.
It's on currency. It's on flags. The Pine
yes.
Tree. I mean, it's through. I had no idea, Trent. None of this is stuff that I knew.
The more you know.
The more you know.
Yes, it was our first currency, the Pine Tree Shilling. The colonists needed something to pay for all their goods and services with.
What is the first Christmas tree in America?
Yeah, there are disputed reports. And, you know, the tradition began in Germany in around 1519. And then the first reports are sometime in the early 1800s, let's say 1805 to 1810. And there was a school in Pennsylvania, and it was a school run by folks of the Christian faith, but primarily used to convert indigenous youth to Christianity, and it had separated them from their parents. And there was a ledger in that school where the teacher had instructed the indigenous children to go out into the woods and cut a tree and bring it back, and they decorated it. So that was the first humble beginning in this country. Mm. And then there were kind of others along the way that were more extravagant. In the 1800s, there was Charles Follin, who was a Harvard professor. He had erected a Christmas tree at a party in Boston, and he invited a writer from a famous magazine called Godey's Lady Book, and she wrote a nice glowing review of his decorated tree, and it kind of took off from there.
You mentioned Rome and the ecological crisis that leads to downfall because we don't have the resources. Prior to the pilgrims coming, these forests are not wild in the sense that you might think of them. They have been managed by Native American tribes. Tell me a little bit about the clash between these two cultures of timber harvest and extraction and shipping overseas to what was already in place and had been in place for ages.
So the colonists enslaved well over a million Native Americans in the timber trade in the 1600s and 1700s. And I can credit that figure to Ned Blackhawk, who's a professor at Yale who won the National Book Award a couple of years back. And the colonists, the European settlers, had a radically different notion of forest management than Native Americans. For millennia, Native Americans had managed these forests with controlled burning. And so they would light these low controlled fires, which would accomplish several things. It would keep the flammable understory in check so that these towering infernos wouldn't be possible. It could clear out parts of the forest, which would provide habitat for animals like deer and moose and elk to move in, which then the Native Americans hunted. It's kind of a myth that the pilgrims arrived to an untouched virgin landscape that was bestowed upon them by God. It was actually an intensely managed forest landscape across this whole continent. Mm. And European settlers viewed it strictly as a resource, as a capital product that could be extracted and shipped overseas and sold. And it began a triangular trade route, really, between Boston, the colonies, and England and the Caribbean, primarily staffed by enslaved Native Americans for a couple hundred years.
I want to stay on this idea of the cost to humans, the great cost to humans throughout time, from enslavement to lumberjacks and the astonishing way that people are treated as invisible, mm-hmm. disposable, only good for the amount of labor they can produce without dignity. There is an intense human cost throughout the entire continent of mm-hmm. of forestry and felling these trees, of the industry as a whole. What do you want to say broadly mm-hmm. about that?
Mm. Well, I did trace the human cost of evergreen extraction in every region of the country. So the one I just described with Native American enslavement in the coastal New England, and then there was the Deep South. And you couldn't just roll in. If you were a white landowner, you couldn't roll into a forested landscape and plant cotton. First, you had to cut down the trees. The timber industry, and especially the evergreen timber industry in the Deep South, really supercharged slavery. And there was a practice of the era called log it and flog it. And the white landowners would go in. They'd make money first off of cutting the trees, and then second by either selling the land or planting cotton. Hmm. And of course, that came at tragic human cost in the Deep South. And then in the Lake States, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, there, timber barons, rather than using enslaved labor, they were essentially liquidating land that had been stolen from indigenous tribes. Stolen, but, you know, the government thought that they had negotiated it away through a series of hundreds of convoluted treaties written in language that the native peoples did not understand, of course, but there you have it. And so they were liquidating land and building fortunes and leaving the native populations hungry and impoverished. And then in the West, so the human consequences of evergreen logging, I think, reached a peak in the West. So let's say, if I can paint this picture, between the Gold Rush, 1849, and World War I, that period of roughly 70 years, the primary labor force in the timber logging industry in California, Washington, and Oregon were queer men. Men on the down low, men who had sex with men. And the word homosexual had not appeared in the English language. It didn't appear until the 1920s. But in that day, you as a gay man, you or anyone suspected of what was called lewd or lascivious behavior as defined by the Comstock Act, you could be rounded up, put in jail, put in a mental institution for life. Tens of thousands of suspected queer men were forcibly sterilized, were castrated, and you couldn't hold a job. It was illegal for someone suspected of lewd behavior to hold a job with the federal government or the state government in that era. So what would you do? How would you find work? And how could you find meaning in your life? Well, the timber barons needed a disposable, invisible labor force because logging in that time was the most deadly profession on earth. If you were a lumberjack working a 10-year career in the forest, you had about a 50-50 chance of dying, of being crushed to death by trees. It was so unsafe, and they were just using rudimentary axes and saws to cut trees that could have been 20 to 30 feet wide. So the timber barons employed hundreds of thousands of these down-on-their-luck men who lived in these in squalid conditions in these timber camps deep in the sequoia forests in California and the Sierra Nevada, all the way up to the Douglas fir groves in Washington and the Sitka spruces in Oregon. And again, a tragic human cost there, hundreds of thousands of lives lost or brutal injuries sustained.
In the historical record, the oral histories and the things that are reported on these relationships, there is a trail there to follow, and you follow it in this book. And I think this book, you say here that this is not a footnote. The queer history in this industry is not a footnote. It is substantial to the entire story, and therefore this book really adds substantially to the research and documentation of queer culture and same-sex relationships in America in a really profoundly effective way. And I thank you for that.
Thank you. Well, thank you. And, you know, being a gay man myself, that was one of the revelations that I found most meaningful, but I also didn't expect. Yeah. I didn't actually know that when I started writing the book.
No.
And when I discovered it, I thought, oh my goodness, I need to follow this trail. And I had originally discovered just a few archival photos of these bachelor weddings and these cowboy stag dances that were taking place in the logging camps. And I thought, well, what's this? You know, we have the image of the hyper-masculine Paul Bunyan,
right?
Yeah. Babe and the Blue Ox, and they can cut a whole forest with one swoop of their axe. And it turns out to be much more interesting and meaningful and sort of tragic than that.
Yeah.
I don't think many LGBT people today, including myself, know that we lack this kind of continuous record of ourselves in history. You know, we grow up thinking that maybe we didn't even exist because we don't see role models and we don't know, we don't have evidence of ourselves. But it turns out not only did we exist then, but we've always been here. And I found that to be an incredibly moving part of the book for me personally to even write.
Yeah. Mm. You mentioned sequoias in this, and I think about these workers. They're not the ones who get wealthy on this. It's the timber barons who are getting wealthy. And then there's the story of the sequoia, and the first one that was really felled, I think it's called the discovery tree, or you call it the discovery tree. They just bring it down to prove that they can do it. It feels like such a senseless act of violence. Tell us a little bit of that story and this idea of part of this attempt is to say we as human beings can land this whale.
Yes, in the book, I compare logging redwood trees to terrestrial whaling.
Yeah.
These trees were the size of between 3 and 6 full-grown humpback whales, and cutting them was every bit as brutal and visceral of an act. And Augustus Dowd, who was a gold miner in 1852, is credited as being the first white person to lay eyes on a giant sequoia. And his fellow miners didn't believe him, so they all rode back to this Calaveras Grove in California. They didn't think anyone would believe that a tree could grow this big. So they cut it down, they cut sections of it, they cut bark off, brought it to San Francisco and put it on display. And it created this worldwide sensation where even in England and in Europe and in cities like Chicago at the World's Fair and New York City, there was a frenzy to display giant redwoods and to show them as sort of an indication of America's grandeur and our unlimited resources, resources that people thought were so big and so vast that they could never possibly be depleted. And it was, you know, a sad twist of events that the first trees to be cut down of this size were only done to prove to people that they existed. Mm. And one of the more tragic ones was displayed on the National Mall by the Smithsonian. And then after the core of this tree rotted for years and years, the landscapers and the gardeners turned it into a tool shed for their lawnmowers and their rakes and things.
You give quite an accounting of what this continent held before these efforts. The 40 million bison, 5 billion passenger pigeons, 50,000 grizzly bears. Before the loggers come in earnest with this massive deforestation process, we see a North American continent that was. It's incredibly sobering to confront our industrial success, but also our excess. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about seeing this happen, and then throughout the narrative, there are also people who are constantly calling it out, the poets and the philosophers and naturalists, and obviously indigenous people who are putting in the record again and again, what you're doing is wrong. What you're doing cannot be sustained. What you're doing is unnecessary and unhelpful.
So you raise a couple of great points there, and I had to collect my thoughts for a second. But one thing that happened as we marched from east to west in this country, cutting down all the trees, killing the bison, killing the grizzly bears, displacing large predators and small, destroying habitats, without the benefit of the internet, for example, or photography, I'm not entirely sure that many people even knew what was going on in other parts of the country. Let's say you were a logger in Wisconsin and you were working for a timber baron and you were clearing 100 acres and your neighbor was clearing 100 acres and 10,000 of your neighbors were also clearing 100 acres. There wasn't necessarily a sense that this was happening all over and that the resources would eventually disappear. I think it's hard for us today to grasp it, and I try as I might, I can't. The staggering enormity of our resource here was so hard for them to comprehend that I don't know if anyone quite understood what was going on until it was already too late.
Yeah.
And the resource was gone.
Yeah, you write of loggers being in genuine shock when they return to an area and see, oh, it didn't replenish itself as fast as we, in our imaginations, thought it would.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if they knew how old the trees were, even.
Yeah.
The tree ring science of knowing how old trees are by counting the growth rings. Some of that didn't really emerge until the 1900s. So, you know, they're cutting down a tree. They think, well, maybe this will grow back in 50 or 100 years.
Yeah.
But the time scale of these things was really between 500 and 3,000 years.
There's also this one little area in the world, which everyone in South Dakota who's listening is going to key into immediately, where trees are growing, and it's a really, really bad thing because of the way the Green Glacier is overtaking the grasslands and making the prairie threatened and near extinction. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the Green Glacier and what you learned in your research.
You know, I went home to visit my mother. And you asked me the story about how we cut down the Christmas tree when I was 8 years old. When I went home to visit my mother in 2022, 23, I was driving from the Sioux Falls airport to Yankton, and I noticed fields and pastures that I remembered being cattle grazing areas that were covered in cedars. And I was thinking, just sort of casually thinking, huh, there are a lot of trees here. Since when does South Dakota have trees? And I asked my mother about it, and she, we visited a friend north of town who is a veterinarian and has a farm, and I was kind of riding around looking at all these cedars. So to get to your main question, for millennia, both the billions of bison that roamed the prairie, in addition to the indigenous peoples who had used controlled burns, had kept the native cedar trees in check. They were confined primarily to the river valleys, the ravines, and sort of along the breaks of the Missouri River. We killed all the bison, and when we pushed out indigenous people and banned the fire management practices, these trees took off. And they have crept out of the river valleys, and they are spreading across millions of acres of the Great Plains. And they're killing the prairie. And the Great Plains is the world's largest remaining grassland ecosystem, and it's incredibly important. And I wanted to add that vignette to the book so that, in a twist, there are parts of this country where we actually need to be cutting down more evergreens. And it's, you know, we cut them down. We cut too many down everywhere else. But on the Great Plains, we need some kind of a concerted effort to just eradicate these cedars. But they're taking over.
That was a moment in the book where I thought this book could only be written by you. You know, like that was just one of those things when I think about authors who are from here.
Yeah.
Bring something different to the storytelling, like that made sense to you, and then you went and did further research on it because you noticed that thing when you came home.
Yes.
And knew it mattered.
I did.
Yeah.
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 Well, and that the time scale felt human.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, in my life, from my teenage years to my current self being 48, I noticed that suddenly the prairie is covered in trees. And I find that it wasn't glacial or epochal. it was like it happened while I was alive.
Have we gotten better? Have we figured out a sustainable way to do this kind of work of modern American industry? Because I'm looking at everything with a different eye now after reading this book. But then I'm also asking these big questions about what are we to do about this? Because the building and the growth is not done. Replacing with plastic, of course. You write about plastic in plastic Christmas trees largely in the book. But we know we can't just replace everything with something else. Where are we at in the shift to profitable but sustainable forestry?
Right. Well, the demand for timber and paper products in this country is so staggering that we had to shift to a tree farming mentality. So, and Weyerhaeuser Corporation was and is today the leader in this, where, and it's America's single largest landowner after the federal government.
Yeah.
And they manage about 12 million acres, and they have a corporate policy that for every tree we cut down, we plant another tree, one or two trees in some cases. And so we have to manage our forests as though it was a crop, just like corn, except that it's the crop is harvested on a 30 to 40 year cycle instead of annually. And for the most part, I think whatever 1% or half of 1% that's left of our original old growth forests are being protected. And we've kind of said, all right, there's nothing left, but the few trees that are here, we're going to keep them. We're going to put them in parks. And then we need to think about how we manage everything else on second and third growth cycles. And that's the only way we can possibly meet demand for timber and paper products. The Menominee peoples of Wisconsin have done a remarkable job. They have a landmark and important stretch of forest on their traditional lands that they're managing sustainably. And they're doing so with such expert skill, and they're harvesting trees selectively based on age and disease pressures, and they actually have more standing timber on the Menominee land today than they did 80 to 100 years ago because they're managing it sustainably. So there are models out there, and hopefully more and more people will come to understand them and employ them.
Let's circle back to the Christmas tree itself and the Christmas tree farm versus the dizzying array of artificial tree choices that we have. You have this wonderful part in the book, it's on page 182, where you say, if I may just momentarily, like many agricultural decisions, the choice each Christmas boils down to two essential options: support local farmers who nurture living evergreens and vibrant communities, or opt for distant industrial manufacturers whose methods burden the planet with pollution and compromise human health. When this choice becomes overwhelming amid the cacophony of glitter and twinkling lights, authentic desires fade, preferences weaken, and consumers struggle to answer a fundamental human question: what do I really want? That just got me. That just punched me right in the gut. What do I really want? We're so overwhelmed and distracted.
Lori, you just read my favorite passage of the book. I don't know how you managed to pick it out, but yeah. What do we want? Do we want authenticity? Do we want a connection to nature? And I think I obviously make no secret of my opinion of plastic trees in the book, and people will have to read to the end to really get there. But I take the plastics industry to the mat in my book, and it only became possible for artificial trees to become a $2 or $3 billion industry. In part, I think, because of our disconnection from farming, our disconnection from nature, and our disconnect from the land. And today, 99% of Christmas trees are grown on farms, small farms, family farms, and they're preserving land, they're providing habitat, and they're growing something that is the most renewable resource we've got. Plastic trees present us with millions of options. These trees now, they have LED lights, and they have a revolving base and a Bluetooth speaker. They even come with a spritz of artificial pine scent. Mm. They've done a remarkable job of challenging America's own relationship to authenticity. We often don't know what we want. And Daniel Kahneman, who is a Nobel Prize-winning economist, did a lot of research on our utility and our relative happiness as we're faced with more choice. Mm. And we see this a lot in the marketplace when you have 100 things to choose from at the store, your conviction is diluted substantially. Mm. So you're like, what do I want? I don't know. There's 20 different colors. And it becomes this like exasperated sigh. And that's where I ended with that portion of the book, that passage that you read.
Yeah. The book is called Evergreen, The Trees That Shaped America. We have only scratched the surface on what is in here. I was delighted. I was interested. I was challenged. And you have saved my Christmas all in one. Oh, Trent Pressler, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Trent Pressler's latest book is called Evergreen, The Trees That Shaped America. The book has been long listed for a PEN America Literary Award, and Evergreen is in bookstores now. That's our conversation for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.